Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, which worldview best explains reality? Ken will discuss how Christianity explains such realities as existence, beginning, design, investigation, and abstractions in part one of what we hope will be three podcasts, Ken.
Yes.
These are some terms that maybe people don't automatically think of, but you're going to help us see what how Christianity relates to these.
Yes. Joe, I think that a very powerful test of worldviews has to do with a worldview's explanatory power and scope. And so how well does a worldview explain reality? And that reality would be the universe, but it would also be us. How does it explain human beings? And then the issue of range, the scope of explanation, how well does it explain an array of issues? So I want to talk a little bit about the truth of the Christian faith and make the case that I think that one of the good reasons for considering the truth of historic Christianity and its accompanying worldview. I don't think Christianity is a worldview, but I think it encompasses a worldview. I think there are good reasons to believe that it's true, and I think largely it's because of its explanatory power. So we're going to get into a little detail about that, and I think that this is a good way of kind of broaching the issue with non-Christians. So hopefully some of this will be very helpful to our folks.
Ken, you've talked about this and written about it before, but maybe for benefit of people who might be new to the podcast, I have found it helpful when you discuss these glasses that we put on, and we see the world through these glasses. Maybe you can explain that illustration.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you bringing that up, Joe. You know, there's a couple different ways of thinking about a worldview. A worldview is the way we view the world. And immediately I think of a pair of glasses. I wear glasses more now than ever before. And, you know, when I look through the lens of these glasses, I like to read. Sometimes I like to get up early in the morning and take a bath, and I like to read. And, you know, the lenses get fogged up.
Yeah.
I also have a pair of blue blocker sunglasses. That takes you back a couple decades. But my story about the blue blocker sunglasses is I used to live out in a little city called San Jacinto, a desert area of Southern California, although I understand really all of Southern California is a desert area. Yeah. Even though it's got an ocean there, it's still desert.
We're not deserted, though. A lot of people here.
That is very true. I can tell you that by driving in this morning. We have a lot of folk in our part of town. Well, I love those blue blocker sunglasses because they would block a lot of the shiny light from the sun. And I felt like reality came into sharper focus, and I thought, wow, these are great glasses. It was only later I saw some drawbacks to them. They distorted color. So when I drive up to a signal light, the green light doesn't look lit. And so I have to take my glasses off to see is it lit or not. And I've also noticed that yellow turns orange. Now, this is a lot like a worldview. A worldview lenses the way we look at the world. And again, this is one analogy. I mean, you could think of a worldview like a compass. That's another analogy. Well, what I like about the pair of glasses is that a worldview can either bring your reality into sharper focus or it can distort it. And that's the way I think it is with all worldviews. None of our worldviews are perfect because they're constructs. They're our big picture view of reality. Another way of thinking about a worldview is to think of it as a cluster of your most important beliefs about life in the world. So your view of God. Usually a person's view of God really kind of starts off because you're asking what's ultimate reality. But your view of the universe, your view of knowledge, your view of ethics, your view of beauty, your view of history, and so those are your kind of big picture parts of a worldview. We could also talk about the Christian worldview in terms of kind of four components: creation, fall, redemption, consummation. That's another way of thinking about a worldview. Dave, I like thinking about worldviews primarily, there's a quote that I was reading the other day by Aristotle. Aristotle said, "The sign of an educated person is they're able to entertain an idea without necessarily agreeing with it." Hmm. And what I like about worldviews, the concept, is it gives me the opportunity to think about worldviews in my mind, compare and contrast them with what other people believe. But I'm not committed to any of that. But it gives me kind of a model. I know you find that attractive, Dave.
I do. I like the worldview framework, as it were, to kind of evaluate other beliefs, other viewpoints that people present, and it gives you a way to discern what is it that's different, that's critically different between, say, someone else's particular viewpoint, religious, whatever it may be, and the position that I take as a Christian, by splitting it up into these different critical components.
Now, Joe, maybe one last point about a worldview. The way we're talking about it is kind of a conceptual scheme, if you will. There are other people who think of a worldview a little differently, or maybe more expansively. For example, people like Tolkien and Lewis, the great authors of the 20th century, they thought of worldview more in terms of storytelling. And so you don't necessarily have this logically arranged scheme. Rather, they'd introduce ideas and kind of tell it to you through a story. Both are appropriate. I'm just more trained in philosophy, and so I gravitate toward kind of this conceptual analysis, if you will.
Another question on worldview. Does everybody have a worldview? The reason I ask is because some people, perhaps a skeptic, might say, I don't bring in any of these biases of a worldview. I just analyze evidence, and then the evidence will lead me to where we should go.
Yeah, good question. Well, I guess I would say a couple things. First of all, I would say I think everybody who thinks and reflects has a worldview. Worldviews might be incomplete. They might be a smorgasbord. You know, I kind of like a little bit of this. I like a little bit of that. So they may not always be coherent. But I think anybody who thinks deeply about life in the world has a worldview. Part of the problem with the individual who might think, you know, I don't have any assumptions. I don't have any preconditions. I just look at evidence and logically analyze them. Well, it doesn't work that way. All of us come to the table with ideas like, well, I can trust logic and mathematics. Why do you have that assumption? Why do you think you have the capacity with your cognitive faculties and sensory organs to be able to trust analysis? Maybe you're an atheist and your brain evolved. Why do you trust something that happened by happenstance? All of us have assumptions. All of us have cultural influences, educational influences. We're all shaped by all kinds of ideas. And all of us have pre-commitments. We have beliefs. There's nothing wrong with that. And there's nothing wrong with admitting that you have limitations and you have boundaries. But I think worldview thinking can be very, very helpful because it kind of teaches you to frame your beliefs in the most coherent way. And as Dave says, it gives you a great opportunity to be able to compare and contrast. You know, sometimes I don't want to talk particularly about Christianity. Maybe I want to talk about theism. I might want to include Judaism, maybe even Islam. So I might want to talk about monotheistic theism. Well, I can go very quickly. And by the way, I would say another advantage to that is I recognize through worldview thinking that I've got a lot of friends. And what I mean by that is I have worldview allies. I know some very conservative Jews. That's a kind of a loaded word because conservative is one of their denominations. I don't mean the particular denomination. You know, you got Orthodox, you've got conservative, you've got Reform Jews. But what I mean by that is I know people who are religious. They're Jewish. They're religious. They have a conservative view of life and ethics and values. And even though they don't believe that Jesus is the Messiah, they're my worldview allies. I would say, for example, Dennis Prager, Michael Medved. Who's the young guy that's—
Ben Shapiro.
Ben Shapiro. I listened to him have a little discussion with William Lane Craig, the great Christian philosopher. And I thought to myself, Ben— is a worldview ally. His view of ethics is very similar to mine. His view of God is very similar to mine, even though he stopped short of believing in Jesus as the Messiah. So he's not a Christian. But it does help us to realize there are times, here's another good example, Plato and Aristotle were pagans, right? We often want to contrast paganism with a biblical perspective. Well, let me let you in on something really important. Aristotle and Plato, in large measure, are allies. They agree a lot with Christianity over against skepticism and relativism and things of that nature. So another advantage for me in thinking worldviews is I realize I'm not being narrow at this point. I think Christians sometimes are very narrow. You know, a person might say, "I'm a Baptist." No, I'm a Pentecostal, and they kind of define things in very narrow areas. I tend not to be that way. I like to think of myself as ecumenical, but there are times we might be narrow. Worldview gives us the capacity to say, "Hey, here's what we have in common with this, you know, frame of thought."
Okay, very good.
Well, let me then begin by, with this kind of introduction to the worldview thinking. One of the important tests of a worldview, as I mentioned, is what I would call the explanatory power and scope test. And I'm going to introduce that by just essentially asking a question. And here's that question. How well does a belief system or a worldview explain the facts of reality? So the facts would be the power of the worldview. And then how wide is the range of explanation? That's the scope. So how well does a worldview explain elements of reality, power, and how much of this does the worldview explain? Well, I would say that a good worldview, a viable worldview, a worldview that we could and should entertain is going to explain reality in sufficient detail. It's going to account for what I'm going to call the external world and the internal world. The external world would be the physical universe. I'm going to talk about that right at the beginning here. I want to look at issues like, why does anything exist at all? Why is there, Dave, a cosmos? I want to look at, where did that cosmos come from? So we use the word beginning. We'll then look at why is the universe, why is it an orderly cosmos rather than a disorderly chaos? That would be design. And then investigation, I think a powerful element. I think this sides with theism very nicely. We live in a universe that we can actually investigate to some degree. There's a lot of mystery in the universe. There's things we don't quite understand, maybe we'll never understand. But one of the striking things about the universe in which we live and the kind of beings that we are is that we can do science. We can actually track the intelligibility of the universe. I would say that counts in favor of God. It's an orderly cosmos. It is also filled with human beings who have brains and minds and sensory organs that work pretty well, not perfectly, but they work pretty well. And of course, the early Christians thought, I should define that, the early Christians who were involved in the development of science in the 1600s, the age of revolution, the scientific revolution is what I mean, not a political or a military revolution. It was essentially the Christians during that period who said, you know, God created the world with nomos and logos, with laws and logic. He's the great architect. He is the great engineer. He's made us in his image. We have the wherewithal to do this. So studying nature's secrets brings glory to God. I think that that's very powerful. And what I would like to be able to do is to share that with non-Christians, particularly skeptical, atheistic Christians, that science in its earliest version was religious. Christians thought that they could bring glory to God by understanding nature's mysteries. So there's that external. A good worldview should be able to explain things, the external world, but then the internal world, maybe every bit as important. That is, what about our hopes and our desires and our aspirations? How about the fact that I've never met a human being that I didn't detect that wasn't flawed? It would have been great to encounter Jesus, I think, and just kind of marvel at him and kind of, you know, try to probe him. And can I find a flaw? I'm so used to my own flaws, I know what to look for. And even in my good friends around this table, who are two of my best friends, Joe and Dave, they're very generous, they're very charitable, they're very supportive of me personally. And yet they see my flaws and I see their flaws. Why? And why this enigma? I'm jumping ahead, but I'm giving them a little flavor, Joe.
There you go.
Why this enigma of what Pascal called greatness and wretchedness? Well, the Christian worldview says the reason human beings are a marvel is because they're made in the image of God. So they can do science. They have language, right? Mortimer Adler says animals don't have language. They send signals to each other. By the way, when I was reading that in Adler, I started looking at my dogs and watching them differently. I was looking, how do they send signals to each other, right? Well, why is it that human beings have greatness and yet wretchedness? That's the internal. And I think that these are powerful ways of looking at things. Now, last point I want to make here as we introduce this idea is I think if you have a worldview that has great explanatory power, then there's a good chance it's plausibly true. And I'll read you a quotation. Robert Harris is a philosopher and an apologist, I think. He has an interesting way of looking at a worldview. He says this, and by the way, all of this that I'm kind of working through now is from my book, Seven Truths That Changed the World. So if you'd like a context, and if I can say something nice about a book that I've written, I usually find fault with the books that I've written because I'm a perfectionist. But one of the things I liked when I was reading this morning to try to remember all these ideas I'd written about is I thought, you know, these are really important ideas, but it's clear. And I think that that's very important to be able to present these ideas as clearly as we possibly can. So if you want a source, Seven Truths That Changed the World, here's a real good quote by Robert Harris. Harris says, when detectives examine a crime scene, their goal is to develop a narrative of events, a story that explains as many of the details of evidence as possible in as plausible a way as possible. In other words, they develop a hypothesis that covers the facts. Similarly, a worldview might be seen as a hypothesis that aims to take into account as many of the observed phenomena of the world, life, and experience as possible in a coherent, unified way. The more phenomena that can be reasonably and plausibly explained by a given hypothesis, the greater the hypothesis's explanatory power. You know, there are times where I do ask myself questions. I remember when I was really sick in the hospital, had 6 abscessed brain lesions. The mortality rate, I later read, was 80%. Most of the doctors who look at my file say, you're lucky to be here.
You beat the odds, and then you went to Vegas right after that.
I beat the odds. I should have gone and put it all on black. Put it all on black. Well, the point I want to make there was when I was sick, I shuffled the deck and I said to myself, "Do you really believe this, Ken? I mean, what if you're wrong? What if you're wrong? What if I lose consciousness and it's all black? That is, there's no God. The universe is all there is, and my entropy has come to visit me. So that life force is gone." Or I thought, what if I'm wrong about religion? My goodness, what if I wake up and Allah is staring me in the face? Mm. Look at all I've done to critique Islam. I kind of fell back on, even though my mind was not terribly clear. By the way, another element, if I could bring up too, Joe and Dave, one of the things I experienced when I was sick is part of my worldview. I realized how important my brain is. I think before that, I largely thought I'm a soul that happens to live in a body. My body's secondary. The real me is my soul. I think I discovered in having that illness, my brain is really me. I am a union of body and soul. And when your body's not working right, you're not working right. Thomas Aquinas even said that in the intermediate state, so that would be after death but before the resurrection, what people who die now would go to, they'd be in the presence of Christ. Thomas Aquinas thought that to be absent of your body is not to be fully human. This is a worldview idea. This is anthropology. What is your view of human beings? Well, my secular friends, who I spar with intellectually, they think they're just a body. Sometimes Christians, I think we're just a soul or just a spirit. But I discovered that I'm a union. Made me also think a little differently about Jesus. Jesus is actually one person who has both a divine and human nature. Well, again, this is part of the idea that these worldview ideas really matter, and we should be able to test them and explain them. So let's start tackling a few of these. We've got a bundle of them, and it'll take us a few shows to make our way through. And I'm referencing this as Christianity's rational explanation. I'm going to argue that Christianity is rational and that one of the foundational elements is that it can explain reality, mm-hmm. Okay? So let's start with the big E word, existence. And what I want to say about existence is I want to quote Gottfried Leibniz, the great philosopher who asked the question, why is there something rather than nothing? Why is there anything at all? Why does anything at all exist? I sometimes wonder, maybe it would be more economical if nothing existed, but something does exist. And then we can start asking ourselves philosophical questions. Why is there something rather than nothing? And if something does exist, and I don't know anybody who denies that, if something exists, then is it more reasonable to conclude that something came from nothing or that something has always existed? And if something has always existed, then is that something the universe or is that something God? Because something coming from absolute nothing makes no sense. Even though it might be articulated by very educated physicists, people like Lawrence Krauss.
One of those physicists or astronomer perhaps said somewhere, I think, Dave, you'll probably remember this better than I would, the universe tunneled its way into existence. And I thought, nah, Ken would be all over that one.
Interesting language that they use. Yeah. Well, here is a formal argument. And so I think God provides a powerful and plausible explanation for the existence of the universe. We'll put it into an argument. This is one form of the cosmological argument. So cosmos would be one of the Greek words for world, right? Premise one, everything that exists requires an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or an external cause. Premise two, the physical, unnecessary universe has an explanation for its existence. That explanation is an external God. Premise three, the universe exists. Conclusion, therefore, the explanation of the universe's existence is God. Well, that's a formal case. All that really means is if something exists, it either exists in itself or somebody made it. That's all that means. If something exists, it either has an internal basis for its own existence, it has an internal necessity, or it's a contingent thing that somebody created. The second premise essentially argues the universe is not an internal necessary reality. One philosopher said, what if you were walking in the forest? Joe and Dave, you both like camping. You like the outdoors, right? I always puzzle in my mind, what is it that my wife sees in nature that makes her smile? What is it in nature that gives her a sense of always anticipating the next hike she wants to go on? Well, I actually think she sees the beauty of the Creator. And it's drawing her. Now, what's going to happen when she sees God face to face? No longer looking at something God made, but looking at God. I don't know. You may want to hold on to something when that happens.
Yeah. Or take some powerful worldview glasses with you there.
That's right. They might dull your senses. Well, suppose you guys are walking in the forest and you see a ball laying there. And, you know, you're out in the middle of nowhere. There's very few human beings. And even if there were, you would still ask yourself, well, where did this come from? How did it get here? What's the explanation for this? Lots of parts of the universe appear to be very, very much contingent, dependent. They're caused. They don't contain an explanation in themselves. Well, the universe is kind of like a big ball. So if the parts of the universe require a cause, why doesn't the whole universe require a cause, right? So this kind of thinking is, if something exists, then it either exists eternally and it has some explanation in itself, or it's caused by another. I would propose that this argument is correct. It's reasonable. It's plausible.
Now, would you say that this requirement that the universe had a beginning or, you know, came into being is contingent, is a philosophical issue or an experimental issue? I mean, experimentally, we've been able to observe the universe and you know, discovered that it's winding down and various things like that, entropy and so on. But from a strictly philosophical perspective, can you argue that the universe is contingent?
I think that you can, Dave. I at least think you can make a framework. For example, I think it's the philosophical framework is that if something exists, then it needs some kind of causal explanation. And that causal explanation is either found in itself, that is, we discover, hey, this doesn't need an explanation, it's a necessary reality, or no, it is It has been caused. It can't explain itself. So it's an effect in need of a cause. So I think the framework that we've laid right. down is philosophical in nature. Now, where I think science is very effective is when you can focus it narrowly on the physical sciences. And in the next argument, which we'll talk about beginning, we'll then look at some scientific evidence. So right now, at least right now, we're looking more broadly at the question of existence. And then we'll shift gears to, did it have a beginning?
But we didn't, philosophically, while we, like you say, we can have a framework for, you know, that kind of gives you an understanding of how to think about it. From that perspective, you don't have the evidence that you need to know that the universe is contingent or doesn't have within itself the ability to, I mean, we in the past we thought that very likely or very possibly the universe is infinite and has always existed.
But even there, and I agree with you, I think just as I want to argue that science has its limits, philosophy also has its limits.
Right.
But there are philosophers, for example, who would argue that an eternal universe is incoherent.
Now, what's the ground for that? Is that something we can explain now? Or?
Well, I'll do it very, very briefly. Okay. Hilbert's hotel, that if there is an eternal, if the universe is eternal, then we've had an infinite amount of time. And here is the problem. How do you get to the end of an infinite? That is, if the universe is eternal, I've had an infinity behind me. But how do I get to the end of an infinite?
Yeah, okay.
So you can use philosophical arguments to critique the idea of an eternal universe. Okay. I don't suggest that that's all you need.
Right.
I think there are some very powerful elements that come after that. But at this point, we're simply arguing, why does anything exist at all?
Right.
And some of the evidence that we've seen both from science and philosophy seems to indicate that the universe needs an explanation. And I think we should ask those types of questions. Why is there anything at all? Wouldn't it in some sense be more economical if nothing existed? But something does exist. And if it does exist, does it contain an explanation in itself? Or do we need a God? Some people would argue, and the classical philosophers, I'm thinking particularly of Thomas Aquinas, Thomas would say, we can make a philosophical case for a deductive argument that God exists. I'm sympathetic, even though I don't always tend to go down the same lines he does. Here I'm looking more at the question of explanatory power. But let's shift gears, Dave, and you've set it up well for us. Now the question number two is beginning. And I'd present it this way. I'd say that the God of the Bible provides a rational, plausible explanation for the universe's beginning. You know, when people say, for example, like, Sean Carroll, who is, I think he is a physicist, cosmologist, Caltech.
Yeah, Caltech.
Smart guy, thoughtful man. You know, he kind of gives the impression that science has made God largely unnecessary. Other people have said that. Richard Dawkins maybe more explicitly has said that, you know, the more we look at science, the less we need from God. I think Stephen Hawking felt that way. I know Peter Atkins says things like that. These scientists seem to either hold or move toward scientism, arguing not just the practice of science, but arguing that the only way you can really know things reliably about the world is through science. I think all of these men move in that direction, although some of them might stop short. Well, I think that's mistaken, and I want to say it for a couple different reasons. In the early part of the 20th century, a lot of the key thinkers in science thought we would discover an eternal universe. And by the middle of the 20th century, once ideas about the Big Bang really began to be tested and evaluated, some of these scientists were not very happy about it. Fred Hoyle, for example, who is said to have called it the Big Bang, it was a term of derision. He realized, wow, if the universe had a beginning, well, what comes next? Did it have a beginner, right? Is there somebody who created it? There were others. Einstein even recognized that, wow, some of my ideas have now led to this idea that the universe is expanding, which would seem to imply it has a beginning. And he was a little turned off by that. There are others who thought the same thing. And so the Big Bang universe, this idea that the universe, matter, energy, space, and time had a singular beginning. Dave, you mentioned entropy, the idea that given enough time, the universe is expanding, it's cooling. Now, if it had been eternal and the process had continued, it would already reached entropy. So this idea that the universe had a beginning and that it is cooling, this has led to Big Bang cosmology. Now, we have talked a lot about alternative explanations like the multiverse, the many worlds hypothesis, but I'm becoming much more skeptical of that idea for a number of reasons. But one of them is I'm beginning to believe that an essential part of science is observation. I'm beginning to think that an essential part of science is, have I drawn my ideas from empirical sources? Is there any empirical evidence for other universes? Can there be? Will there ever be? Can there conceivably be? I don't know. Maybe my colleague and friend Jeff Swerink might say, well, there is kind of a mathematical framework for it. But maybe I could say, if you have an ensemble of universes, then you just have a large number of unexplained contingent realities. So what do you get? Well, here's the Kalam cosmological argument. Some of you are familiar with the Kalam. By the way, the word Kalam is Arabic. And we talked about worldviews earlier. Sometimes Muslims and Christians and Jews agree with each other. They agree with each other about the need for a creator, for example. So Kalam and about 800 in Baghdad, Islam was thriving. It had a much more, can I say, philosophical flavor. I think it went away from that and became more of a legalistic religion, a religion of laws, rather than a religion of philosophy. And I think in some ways it's lost some of its intellectual appeal. But the Kalam argument was actually presented first by Muslims. Christians came along and said, hey, that looks pretty good. Here's the argument. Premise one, and I should tell you what an argument is. It's really a very simple thing. An argument is where you make a claim. We call that the conclusion, and you seek to support the claim. Those are called the premises. And the better, the tighter your premises are in supporting the conclusion, then the better the argument is, right? And if you can do it with certainty, it's deduction. If you can do it with a degree of probability, it's induction. If you do it the way I'm going to try to do it, in terms of explanation, it's abduction. And that's not to be related to UFO beings. Here's premise one. Whatever begins to exist has a cause for its coming into being. The universe began to exist, premise two. Therefore, the universe has a cause for its coming into being. I think, for example, whatever begins to exist has a cause for its coming into being. Basic principle of cosmology, of causality, is that something cannot come from absolute nothing. I mean, I've listened to Professor Krauss, Lawrence Krauss, who teaches at Arizona State University. He's an outspoken atheist. He's a leading physicist. I've heard him talk about things coming from nothing, but when he says nothing, he doesn't really mean nothing. No matter, no energy, no space, no time, no potential, no mind, nothing, absolute nothing, something coming from absolute nothing. I would say something coming from absolute nothing is impossible. I would say it's absurd to reason that way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, look at your worldviews. Now, sometimes, given your worldview commits you to certain things. I was listening to N.T. Wright, the famous New Testament scholar, and he mentioned that he wrote his book, this large volume that I've read every word of, about the resurrection. And he sent it to his advisor at Oxford University. And his advisor said, Tom, N.T. Wright, Tom Wright, Tom, I can't fault it. It's your work is genius. But I'm not a theist. I'm a naturalist. I hold a different worldview, so I can't conceivably accept a miracle. I can't fault your arguments, your historical, your exegetical reasoning. I just don't hold your worldview. And in my worldview, miracles are not possible. Well, sometimes we get confronted in our worldviews. I'll give you a good example of how Christians get confronted in their worldviews. Every time I drive by the Children's Hospital of Orange County, I feel a pain inside me. I know that in those stories, there are a lot of young children who have cancer. And there's something about that that just doesn't sit right with me. I wonder, Lord, why? I'm a little older, I may deserve some suffering in my life, but do these kids deserve suffering in their life? And I've been up in that building, and I've seen their swollen little heads, and my heart aches. And I think, well, I'm a fallen person and imperfect, and yet I see the pain in their eyes, and I'd like to take that pain. I've often said to the Lord, he doesn't always listen to me, by the way. I told him, Lord, if there's any suffering to be had in my family, I'll take it. Rather than my kids having cancer or my wife having cancer, give it to me. I'll take it. Now, I don't want it, but I'll take it. But you see, the argument that can be made and is made is, well, Ken, you're a fallen creature and you're bothered that kids have cancer. How come your God's not bothered? Well, I think the Lord is bothered. I think that the Lord allows things. To paraphrase Johnny Erickson, I think the Lord does allow things that he doesn't like, but he allows them for purposes that are of his sovereign decision. And so this isn't the only world. Those children are going to exist in another world. And suffering is a severe mercy. You know, I'm afraid of death. I've often tried to get myself ahead of it. I've often figured maybe if I think a lot about death, it'll lose its fear. So I've taught courses in philosophy on death and dying. I like to visit cemeteries. I try to confront death and look it in the eye and say, take me on. But when I was sick, I have to tell you, even after all of my friends and family praying for me, I was afraid to die. I was still afraid of it. Now, the question, though, is if there is another world— and God has plans for that world. Maybe it's good that death is a fearful thing, because that's how God gets your attention. One of my mentors, Walter Martin, boy, I sure wish Walter was alive and could sit on the podcast with us. Walter used to say that sometimes men won't look up until they're flat on their back. St. Augustine called death suffering a severe mercy. It reaches out and grabs you. And you got only one place to look. Well, as terrible it is to see those little kids with cancer, God can bring good out of suffering. And we live in a fallen world. We live in a world where bad things happen to people. But this, again, tells us that we all confront various issues. And as we talk about this, I think that there's powerful evidence that the universe began. I think we see it in the basic principles of Big Bang cosmology, that the universe is expanding, the universe is cooling, that something can't come from nothing. that even though the Big Bang's been around for 50, 60 years now, a lot of the tests that we work on it's held up. And I'll tell you what I think. I think sometimes all of us, and I'm included in it, I think sometimes we look at things and we don't draw conclusions based upon pure logical analysis. We sometimes don't want to believe certain things. Fred Hoyle says, "I don't like the Big Bang. I don't like it," and apparently went to his grave trying to disprove it. I think it's possible that people want a multiverse. Hey, can I step aside? Now, don't get me wrong. There may be evidence for it. And by the way, another argument in favor of a Christian view, maybe God created the multiverse. Maybe we're just getting a glimmer of the greater creation of God.
One of the things that you have done, explanations you've given in the past, I really liked, and that was, and maybe you want to take over from my fumbling here, but the idea that if we accept the fact that the universe that we know, the observable universe, had a beginning, that something had to bring it into existence, that there has to be something that is some reality that is eternal,
yeah,
that is non-contingent, outside of the universe.
That's right.
Transcendent, that brought it into existence.
Yeah.
And the question is, what is that reality? Is that reality God? Or is that reality the multiverse? Or is it some other non-contingent reality that brought it into existence?
Yeah, very good. I mean, a contingent reality is something that can't explain itself. The buck can't stop there, right? Harry Truman's desk, the buck stops here. I wish we had a Washington that was more like that, where senators and congressmen says the buck stops here. Well, we want to pass the buck, but a contingent is not something that explains itself. It's caused. It can't bring itself into existence. Dave, everything we know about the universe indicates it's contingent. We can move down the line and say, well, maybe this universe got started, sparked by another universe, which ultimately there's this mechanism out there, a universe-generating mechanism called the multiverse. But even if we think speculatively, it seems that even that needs some kind of explanation. And we can also then begin to say, can the multiverse explain consciousness? Can the multiverse explain personality? Can the multiverse explain morality? That is, Dave, even if we reach this idea of some brute reality, we still need a reality that can explain all of these. And God can. You know, if God exists and God is essentially kind of an invisible mind, it's not a surprise that he would create creatures who have minds. If God is a moral being, it wouldn't be shocking that he would create creatures who have a moral conscience. So part of this explanatory element is to say, at the end, when we get to the end of our shows, I'm going to make the case that a cumulative case is possible, that God is able to explain not only that the universe exists, but that it's fine-tuned, that it's investigatable, but that human beings have all of these qualities. So yeah, I think it's a powerful point. If anything now exists, then something must be eternal, or something non-eternal emerge from nothing. And something emerging from absolutely nothing, with all due respect to Lawrence Krauss and even Stephen Hawking, I don't think that that's reasonable. Therefore, if something exists, then something must be eternal. And is it an eternal brute physical reality, or is it an eternal God? I think God has the greater explanatory power. Now, let's shift again. Let's talk about the word design. And I'm going to throw a couple ideas together. I'm going to say, for example, the existence of the God of the Bible provides a rational, plausible explanation for complex order, design, and elegance within the universe? I mean, these fundamental constants, right? You know, I mean, that I think is a very, very powerful thing. You have the four fundamental constants. And the way that some scientists, philosophers of science have talked about it is, you know, think of a control board where you have these knobs, and you have to make them all dialed in order to allow for the possibility that complex human life would even be possible. And physicist, maybe I can find a quote I'm looking for here from a particular philosopher. But while I'm looking for it, I'll make this comment. Yeah, I found it. Here is the comment that if these fundamental constants were changed in greater or lesser ways, life wouldn't be possible. Here's the quote from philosopher of science Robin Collins. He says, quote, "Almost everything about the basic structure of the universe, for example, the fundamental laws and parameters of physics and the initial distribution of matter and energy, is balanced on a razor's edge for life to occur." Well, this has led other people to say extraordinary things. You know, how do we account for this kind of experience? We could say, for example, is fine-tuning explained because that's the way the nature of the universe had to be? Did the universe have to be this way? Or did we just get lucky? So is it by necessity, or is it by accident, or is there a designer? Well, here's some quotations for you to give some consideration to. Here is Paul Davies. He says this. He says, "It seems then that the physical universe does not have to be the way it is. It could have been otherwise." That is, the universe didn't have to be an orderly cosmos. It could have been a disorderly chaos. Roger Penrose says that 10 to the 123rd would be the chances of arriving at a universe. So again, if we set that argument up this way, the fine-tuning of the universe must result from physical necessity, chance, or design. Premise two, it does not result from physical necessity or chance, therefore it results from design. I think that argument is more sound than its alternative. Davies says it's not by physical necessity. The universe could have been otherwise. Roger Penrose says chance. It's so wild that it's inconceivable. So if it's not necessity, and it's not chance, then what are we left with? Design.
Of course, the multiverse has been invented to sort of give an explanation for chance, in the sense that there's a huge number, maybe an infinite number of universes out there with all kinds of different properties.
Now,
happen to live in the one.
Here's my challenge to that.
Yeah.
Now we have an infinite number of unexplained universes. Because yeah. I don't think it's just, there's one of those universes that has all the narrowly drawn parameters. Right. I think you have all of these unexplained universes. And so I think we're being presented kind of a how could I put it? I think that explanation plays fast and loose.
Well, it's the flipping of the coin, you know. It's supposed to be heads 100 times in a row. So you invent some machinery out there that you can't observe and you don't really know exists that are flipping coins, and one of those happens to flip 100 heads in a row, and that's the universe that we live in.
And think of the reasoning, though. And I'm relying on Richard Swinburne. Richard Swinburne says, "So I have to come up with a near infinite number of realities to explain one universe, our universe." He says, "Why not just one God and one universe?"
Right.
rather than an infinite number of universes that don't provide any ultimate explanation. But it is a give and take. It's a back and forth, right?
That's their ultimate reality to explain this contingent reality.
And I'm wondering, how much can it explain?
Well, that's your principal point.
Yeah.
Is, okay, if we take that infinite reality, does it provide explanations for mind and character and morality?
Yeah.
And all of these other things.
And that's the point we're emphasizing, that the broader a worldview's explanatory power and scope, the more plausible that we're getting a true vision of reality. Okay, well, let's switch ahead here. Let's talk about the word investigation. I can put it this way. The existence of the God of the Bible provides a rationally plausible explanation for the cosmos's susceptibility to rational investigation. I've mentioned before on our program that Paul Davies has said one of the things that he finds hard to understand is, why is the universe so intelligible? Albert Einstein said that too. He said that one of the profound things, he said one of the most unintelligible things is that the universe is intelligible. It's shocking. We live in a universe that exhibits design or something like design, and we're creatures who have evolved by purely natural processes with minds that help us detect that. I think Davies has even said that kind of keeps him up at night. How do I explain that? Well,
there's another individual, a mathematician, Eugene Wigner, who expresses amazement that the mathematics, which comes from our mind, is able to be quite remarkably adequate in describing the physical characteristics of our universe.
That's exactly right. I read one of his quotations recently. Yeah. Again, so what we're saying here is this idea that the universe is susceptible to investigation provokes thought in the minds of religious and non-religious. Why? Why is it that way? Here's Greg Ganzel. Professor Ganzel is a philosopher who teaches at Talbot. I know him and think very highly of him. He says, "The fact that the universe is made by a mind for reasons leads us to expect that it can be grasped rationally. It makes sense that the stable laws would allow predictions to be made and inferences to be drawn." He then says this, "A naturalist universe, however, would not have to be susceptible to rational investigation. It fits perfectly well with a naturalistic universe that is wildly chaotic." He continues, "Of course, being susceptible to rational investigation is not incompatible with a universe without God, but the theory that God does not exist allows the universe to exhibit any one of a wide array of descriptions as far as order is concerned." So here is the argument. If there's no God, then I think we should be shocked by the intelligibility of the universe. Because think about it. There's no mind behind the universe. Human beings are the product of blind, mechanistic, natural processes. We got so lucky that we developed a brain that I guess caused a mind that then is able to detect the mathematical framework evident in the universe. But let me give you maybe a better explanation. What if there is a great architect in the sky? You know, atheists sometimes like to laugh and say, "You believe in an invisible man?" Well, yeah, I do. What if there is a being that is not physical but merely immaterial, is a mind, and he created the universe? If that's the case, then we shouldn't be surprised, because the biblical idea would be God created the world with nomos and logos, laws and logic. Then he created us in his image. Then he networked the universe and us to himself. And so through the logos, we can track the intelligibility of the universe. It makes sense. At least it makes sense from the standpoint that in a Jewish Christian theistic context, you should expect that the universe would be intelligible. Without God, you've got some explaining to do.
Speaking of explaining, would you say then, can those people who like to wax Sagan-esque, if that's a term, the universe is all that there is, was, ever will be, however he said that, mm-hmm. people like Neil deGrasse Tyson might say, we just need to investigate more into the universe to discover its secrets. Would you say that he's borrowing Christian capital there without acknowledging it?
Well, yeah, I really do. And this is a point that I think is important, Joe. I think that because Christianity and science have now been largely separated from each other by 300 or 400 years, people are often not aware. I bump into visiting scholars who come to Reasons to Believe, and they have PhD in a particular field. They become part of our science faith community. I'll sometimes talk to them about philosophy of science or history of science. They say, I had no awareness that Christianity was so deeply involved in the birth of science. They're essentially saying, I didn't know the historical connection that Christianity and science have an intimate relationship with one another. I didn't know, for example, that the philosophical assumptions of which science is built are so compatible with theism. So when I read Neil deGrasse Tyson, what I see is science works, but I think he needs to ask the question, why does it work? And I think what you'll discover then is science has beliefs that can't be grounded in the scientific method itself. Just one example, you don't discover the truth and validity of math and logic by observation. By empirical observation, those are assumptions we start with. They work, but that doesn't justify, your experiments don't justify them. So I do think that all of us are smugglers, if you will. All of us have worldview ideas, assumptions that we bring to the table. And I think science has been so spectacularly successful. And, you know, here I'll simply comment, Alistair McGrath would say, for example, who has, for goodness sakes, has 3 doctoral degrees, one of them is in science. He says that the scientific enterprise is one of the most profound enterprises that human beings have ever developed. And I think that's right. I mean, think about it. Think about a mechanism that the implications of it in technology and medicine expand your life. I mean, think about how dependent you are on going to the doctor, paying your copay, going to Walgreens and getting your medication. You know, with my doctor, every 6 months he wants me to do a blood test, and then he sends me a list of, here's all your scores. You know, you need to eat less carbohydrates, need to get away from the sugar, and this is the product of science. And so this again is part of the idea. There's 2 things I don't think you want to do. I don't think you want to deify science. That's scientism. But neither do you want to defy it. And I think sometimes Christians get very close to that. I think sometimes Christians, and I want to be as charitable as I can, I think sometimes young earth creationism defies science in the sense that they view it as such a challenge, modern science may be such a challenge, that we can't trust them. But I think both of those you want to avoid. I think you want to acknowledge science, but not scientism. Mm-hmm. Last point, and I'm running a little long here, but these faithful listeners of Straight Thinking, they put up with a lot.
Some of them have long commutes, Ken.
Thank you very much. Yes, abstractions. What are abstractions? These are things like numbers. propositions, sets, properties, the laws of logic, moral values, universals. These are things you can't see, right? You know, I was thinking one day, this was the good old days when Pluto was a planet. By the way, Dave, I discovered that Pluto is smaller than the moon. That surprised me. That's pretty small. It got demoted. I wonder if it got any, you know, did it have an opportunity to object and to
there
to
were
say,
a lot of people who object.
Hey, wait a second here. I think I belong in the upper tier. Well, I was in the old days when Pluto was a planet, and my number 9 is my favorite number because that's Ted Williams's number. Baseball has a lot of numbers, and 9 is a prominent number in baseball. 9 players, 9 innings. Well, here's my thought experiment for you. In the days in which there were 9 planets, before any human beings existed, how many planets were in existence? 9. So, but there were 9 planets before there was any mind to come up with the number 9? Somebody like St. Augustine would say that 9-ness is an eternal idea. How many planets were there before there was a human being to count them? 9. So it seems that these numbers go beyond us. 9-ness is a reality. It's non-physical. It's immaterial. Mathematics, I think, logic, these abstractions, how do we best explain them? Are they things we just arbitrarily make up? Or do they have an existence all their own? Or should we introduce Plato's theory of forms and say, well, maybe there's a whole world of them? But even Max Tegmark, professor at MIT, physicist, Dave, Max Tegmark says, well, we need a couple worlds to explain our world. We need, you know, this world, but then we need a world of mind, and then we need a world of math. And I'm thinking, he gets it. We need these explanations. Now, the Christian perspective on this, and not all Christians agree, which, by the way, I think is a very important point. Sometimes I think you have a lot of open-mindedness in Christianity. For example, I think if you read some of the best Christian philosophers, I like the way they will often entertain alternatives to their view. You know, if you, for example, if you read Alvin Plantinga or Richard Swinburne, they'll often explain the other versions, the other alternative views, better than the people who hold them. But sometimes when I listen to other people who don't hold the Christian worldview, they don't always do a very good job of explaining the Christian worldview. There's a part of Christianity that appeals to me, and that is Christians are open-minded. We have kind of a differing perspectives. And even though I'm a unity guy, I wish Christians were more unified. I wish Catholics, Orthodox, and Protestants could get along a lot better. I wish Christians could try to find more unity. I tend to be a unity and ecumenical guy. Maybe there is a benefit to Christianity in that we have a diverse perspectives. Well, the basic position that most Christians take with abstractions is they come out of the mind of God. Where do numbers come from? Where do the laws of logic come from? Where does morality come from? God didn't create morality. He didn't create the laws of logic. He didn't make up numbers. They flow from his mind.
So, Ken, just to be sure for people who might be thinking, say, in the area of extrasolar planet research, it's not that the planet hasn't been discovered yet, although certainly that's the case as we continue to add these discoveries. But whatever that number is,
yeah,
it already exists because those numbers existed. It's not the planet that we're talking about necessarily, but the number. That concept comes from
something. Yeah, and it's a thought experiment. Yeah. It's saying, okay, let's say there's only 8 planets. Now, 8's not nearly as elegant as 9.
What do you mean?
But
2 cubed is 8. 2 to the 3rd power.
Okay, all right.
Oh, wonderful.
The physicist is pushing me around here. But the thought experiment, I think, is a powerful one, and that is that eightness or nineness seemed to exist before a mind was there to observe it or to create it. And this is St. Augustine's idea. It's a Platonic idea, which again gets us to emphasize sometimes those pagans got certain things right and they got things wrong. But the idea is nineness, not necessarily the number, right? I mean, nine is this number, but the concept of nineness seems to predate the human mind. So those are five: existence, beginning, design, investigation, abstractions. This is kind of part of our series. We're calling it Christianity's Rational Explanation. We're going to do a couple more programs, the Lord willing, if I make it through traffic and can get here to the studio to do it. And I have to keep it, my hands at 10 and 2, even though I'm thinking philosophically. And breathing in all of that carbon footprint.
Oh, so you're not one of those weavers. We weave in and out of traffic.
I'm a very pragmatic driver, even though I'm philosophically inclined. Next time, we'll look at some more ideas. And Joe, this is again the point that I think a good reason for believing that Christianity is true, that the Christian worldview is correct, is its explanatory power and scope. And so we've looked at five. Hopefully, we'll look at 10 more.
All right, terrific. And these are based on your book, as you explained earlier. Seven Truths? Is that the book that we're looking at?
Seven Truths.
Seven Truths that Change the World. You can come to our website here, reasons.org.
You also have the World of...
World of Difference?
The World of Difference.
Yes, that's my primary worldview text.
Right.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Very good.
So check out both of those if you haven't read them yet. You'll be enriched by them. All right, that's going to wrap it up for this podcast. We'd like to hear from you. Let us know your comments and questions. You can reach Ken on Twitter at @RTB_KSamples. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, and Spotify. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.